for the printer, and, together with another experienced co-worker, Sarah Breslin, was wrapping up Mrs. Fleming's long-standing effort to measure the variables she had discovered against the 222 star sequences she tailor-made for that purpose. Miss Maury had fled once more to the old Draper homestead at Hastings-on-Hudson. Resuming the hunt for new variable stars on the Harvard sky maps, Miss Leavitt continued to ponder the thousands she had encountered in the Magellanic clouds. The prevalence of variables in those two southern star clouds beggared all comparison. Miss Leavitt had tallied more than 900 in the small cloud and 800 in the large, without even venturing into the cloud's centers, where stars clumped inseparably together. If the stars were equally dense over the whole sky, Solon Bailey guessed, their number would exceed 10 billions, and the sky would be so luminous that there would be no real night. Bailey had scanned the southern sky at Arequipa, from the decks of ships in the south latitudes and on the Great Karoo of South Africa. In the perfect darkness of those remote sites, he had seen the star-spangled Milky Way spill across the night's horizons. His telescopes had collapsed the vast distances to immerse him in that river of stars. Miss Leavitt, denied such intimacy with the heavens, could only imagine herself standing agape in the Andes, under the southern meanders of the Milky Way, watching the Magellanic clouds trail after the star stream like a pair of lost sheep. Bailey believed the two clouds to be unique structures, separate from the Milky Way. If so, if they in fact existed outside the bounds of the galaxy, then each cloud constituted its own so-called island universe. Possibly the numerous other splotchy white nebulous objects scattered through space were also separate star systems, independent of the Milky Way. Bailey's 2- and 4-hour exposures of the Magellanic clouds, taken with the Bruce telescope, had revealed crowds of stars as faint as 17th magnitude. Miss Leavitt picked her way among them in her initial study by repeating the Bailey's globular cluster strategy. She ruled a reticule of 1 centimeter squares on a glass plate, rendering it a transparent sheet of graph paper. Then, superposing the reticule on images of the clouds, she cordoned off small groups of stars and charted them through an eyepiece fitted with micrometrical crosshairs. Immune to all distractions, she differentiated the individual members, numbered them, recorded their relative positions, and tracked the variables' brightness changes through time. The proximity of variables to one another complicated her task, as did their distances from suitable comparison stars. The pattern of the variables' alteration also challenged her, since most of them remained at their dimmest most of the time, brightening suddenly in short bursts. In her 1908 publication, 1,777 Variables in the Magellanic Clouds, she gauged all the ranges of magnitude and gave the maximum and minimum value for every star as best she could. She traced the complete light curves of only 16 stars. Yet this small select sample, 1/100th of the whole, had shown an intriguing trend. The brighter variables had the longer periods, as though the one thing depended on the other. Since the 16 variables all belonged to the compact small cloud, Miss Leavitt reasoned they all lay roughly the same distance from Earth, just as all her relatives in Beloit lived about equally far from Cambridge. Therefore, the ones that looked brighter must actually be brighter. The unexpected correlation of brightness with period could be mere coincidence, as Miss Leavitt well knew. But if the same pattern held true for a larger number of similar variables, then the correlation itself might indicate something stupendous. In 1911, Miss Leavitt tracked the step-by-step variation in another 9 stars on the glass plates. As before, the brighter variables took the longest time to cycle through their variations. She plotted the numbers on a graph. With period lengths along the x-axis, maximum and minimum magnitudes on the y. Connecting the dots, she got two smooth curves, and when she reduced the periods to a logarithmic scale, her curves snapped into straight lines. The trend among Miss Leavitt's stars was real. Pickering called it remarkable when he announced her results in a Harvard College Observatory circular on March 3, 1912. He used the word law to describe the findings she had demonstrated for 25 stars in the small Magellanic Cloud. The brighter the magnitude, the longer the period. It meant that certain types of variables telegraphed their true magnitudes in the duration of their light cycles. Those stars heralded the coming of distant markers in the farther reaches of space. As soon as astronomers learned the key to the stellar code, the degree of brightness linked to each period, they could determine the stellar magnitudes by watching a clock, then leap the interstellar distances on the wings of Isaac Newton's inverse square law. A variable only one quarter as bright as another of the same period must lie twice as far away. Einar Hertzsprung in Denmark seized on Miss Leavitt's period luminosity relation. He, too, had been drawing graphs, plotting one stellar characteristic against another to test their interdependence. Like many, but not all of his contemporaries, Hertzsprung saw the Draper spectral classification as a temperature gradient. The blue-white O stars were the hottest, the red M the coolest. Two red stars of nearly identical spectra, therefore, shared the same temperature. If one of them looked brighter than the other, then it must be either closer or larger. Hertzsprung could often judge relative distances between two such stars by their proper motion. If the farther one, the star that moved less, was the brighter of the two, then it necessarily had more surface area from which to radiate its light. This reasoning had opened Hertzsprung's mind to the possibility of exceptionally large stars, or giants. In the past, he had lauded Miss Morey for noticing the spectral nuance that could separate giants from dwarfs. Now, he thanked Miss Leavitt for the means to measure distances previously beyond reach. Hertzsprung identified about a dozen examples of stars like Miss Leavitt's within the Milky Way. They followed the same kind of light curve, with a steep rise to peak brightness giving way to gradual decline. These stars shone many orders of magnitude brighter than their peers of the same period among Miss Leavitt's stars. The differences put the small Magellanic Cloud, by Hertzsprung's reckoning, at a distance of 30,000 light years, a chasm so great as to strain credulity. Henry Norris Russell followed some of Hertzsprung's same ideas to similar conclusions about size, brightness, and distance. Based on his own calculations, Russell posited that Miss Leavitt's variables and their yellow counterparts in the Milky Way were all giants. Miss Leavitt herself did not pursue these lines of research. She advanced the hunt for new variables in her Third of the Sky and went on fine-tuning the magnitudes of the North Polar sequence, allowing others to build on the strength of her relationship. On Nantucket Island, off the coast of Massachusetts, where Maria Mitchell had made her world-renowned comet discovery in 1847, a small observatory commemorated her good name. The Maria Mitchell Association occupied the astronomer's birthplace on Vestal Street, and a domed structure next door to it. The association was founded in 1902. 13 years after Miss Mitchell's death, by her cousin Lydia Swain Mitchell, who had also been born in the house on Vestal Street. Cousin Lydia, now Mrs. Charles Hinchman, lived in Philadelphia with her husband and children, but returned to Nantucket every summer, and felt a duty to keep the spirit of astronomy alive on the island. She frequently consulted the director of the Harvard College Observatory for advice, and asked him to recommend guest lecturers. For several years, beginning in 1906, Annie Jump Cannon made a summer pilgrimage to Nantucket in this capacity. She also taught a correspondence course in astronomy and helped bring Ida Whiteside of the Wellesley Observatory and Professor Florence Harpam of the College for Women at Columbia, South Carolina, to the island as summer observers. At moon nights, the public got to look up through Mariah Mitchell's own 3-inch comet seeker, and also the 5-inch Alvin Clark telescope purchased for her in 1859 by a group of admirers called the Women of America. The popularity of the Vestal Street activities gave Mrs. Hinchman the idea of awarding a year-long stipend to a young lady who could conduct research at the observatory while instructing the locals in star lore. An appeal to Andrew Carnegie garnered $10,000 toward the goal. In 1912, Margaret Harwood, a Harvard computer, received the first $1,000 astronomical fellowship of the Nantucket Mariah Mitchell Association. Miss Harwood had joined the Harvard staff in 1907, recruited from that year's Radcliffe graduating class by her astronomy professor, Arthur Searle. Having boarded with Arthur and Emma Searle and their daughters since her freshman year of college, Miss Harwood was a familiar face at the observatory even before day one of her employment. At first, she assisted Searle, whom she called her father in astronomy, by computing the orbits of comets. She helped Miss Leavitt assess the photographic magnitudes of circumpolar variables on the glass plates and learned from Miss Cannon how to observe them by telescope. Pickering enlisted her aid in recalculating the positions of 16,000 stars cataloged by the Bonds in the 1850s. The Mariah Mitchell Association invited Miss Harwood to carry on her research at Harvard for the first half of her fellowship year, and then transfer in June to Nantucket, where they accommodated her through December in an upstairs bedroom of the Mitchell residence. Downstairs in the museum proper, her housemates included collections of Nantucket flora and fauna, fossil displays, and a library about equally divided between astronomy and natural history topics. On Monday nights in the parlor, she gave a lecture that spilled out onto the lawn or into the next-door observatory for stargazing. When Professor Pickering visited, he declared the site, remote from the smoke and glare of cities, ideally suited to the study of asteroids by photographic telescope, and the association raised the funds to purchase such an instrument. Miss Harwood so thoroughly endeared herself to the Mitchell family members and the Vassar alumni who endowed her position that they all looked forward to her return for a second season in the summer of 1913. On another island, far south of Nantucket, William Pickering established a one-man observatory at Mandeville, Jamaica. William had first tested Jamaica as an observing site in 1899, when he repaired there for a family vacation and noticed a pleasant clarity in the air. In October 1900, after convincing his brother of Jamaica's suitability as an outpost in the Eros campaign, William returned for a 6-month stay with his family and a new telescope at a rented Mandeville estate named Woodlawn. Unfortunately, he failed to get good pictures of Eros. In an attempt to salvage the expedition, he remained at Woodlawn through August 1901, photographing the moon for a lunar atlas that he later published. Over the next several years, while William maintained a base at Cambridge, he pursued the moon and planets from sites in California, Hawaii, Alaska, the Azores, and the Sandwich Islands. In 1911, when his risky investments failed and ruined William financially, Edward helped him relocate temporarily to the familiar Woodlawn grounds. The 11-inch Draper refractor accompanied William to what he euphemistically termed the Harvard Astronomical Station in Jamaica. Woodlawn, once a 1,000-acre plantation, owned an ideal telescope mounting site on a patio previously used to dry coffee beans. William's $2,500 annual salary stretched further in the Caribbean than in Cambridge, and he pronounced the seeing at Mandeville the equal of Flagstaff's or Arequipa's. He could see no reason to leave. Thus, the tropical Woodlawn estate became the Woodlawn Observatory. and William Pickering, its astronomical lord of the manor. Isolated and increasingly eccentric, he spoke out as he pleased about the Martian canals, the green vegetation on the red planet, and the likelihood that Mars supported some kind of animal life. Miss Cannon had classified 100,000 stars when she set the work aside to spend the summer of 1913 in Europe with her sister, Mrs. Marshall. They planned to attend 3 major astronomy meetings on the continent, plus all the banquets, garden parties, excursions, and entertainments that such international congresses entailed. On her previous trip to Europe, with her friend and Wellesley classmate Sarah Potter in 1892, Miss Cannon had made the grand tour of popular tourist destinations, camera in hand. This time, she would go as a respected astronomer and the only female officer in her professional organization. At the 1912 meeting of the Astronomical and Astrophysical Society of America, the members had voted to change their name to the American Astronomical Society and to make Miss Cannon their treasurer. Now she would seek out her foreign colleagues, many of whom she knew only by reputation or correspondence, in their native settings. "There are no women assistants," Miss Cannon noted of the Royal Observatory, Greenwich. Travel broadened her appreciation for the singularity of Harvard's large female staff, although she easily befriended men wherever she went. At Greenwich, without the slightest feeling of being out of place, without the smallest tinge of embarrassment, I discussed absorbing work with one and another. That evening, the Astronomer Royal, Frank Dyson, called for Miss Cannon and Mrs. Marshall at their London hotel and escorted them to a soiree at Burlington House, the headquarters of the Royal Astronomical Society and 4 other scientific fraternities. "Never has it been my good fortune to have such a kindly greeting, such hearty goodwill, such wonderful feeling of equality in the great world of research as among these great Englishmen." At the Society's meeting a few days later, she gave a formal presentation about her recent investigation into the spectra of gaseous nebulae. Mrs. Marshall understandably avoided the scientific sessions, at which Miss Cannon inured herself to being the sole woman in a roomful of as many as 90 men. In Germany, she reported, not a single German woman attended these Hamburg meetings of the Astronomische Gesellschaft. Once or twice, 2 or 3 would come in for a few minutes, but I was generally the only woman to sit through a session. This was not so pleasant, but at the recesses the men were so kind that nothing seemed to matter, and at the luncheon women appeared in great numbers. In Bonn, where the Solar Union gathered from July 30th to August 5th, the astronomers were treated to a flyby visit of a military Zeppelin, a side trip to the Gothic Cathedral at Cologne, a riverboat ride up the Rhine, and a gala night in the Bonn Observatory that prompted the English-speaking delegates to sing "They Are Jolly Good Fellows" to director Friedrich Kustner and his wife and daughters. "Luncheon, and indeed all meals in Germany," observed Canadian astrophysicist John Stanley Plaskett, "are a much more important and solemn function than with us, and take at least twice the time." Pickering, an elder statesman in this community, spoke at several banquets during the week. He shared impressions of his previous stays in Bonn, a city he had long regarded as the world capital of photometry. It was here that the legendary Friedrich Wilhelm Argelander assembled the Bonner Durchmusterung star catalog and perfected the Argelander method of studying variables by comparing them to their steady neighbors. Argelander's own small telescope, still mounted at the Bonn Observatory, proved an object of veneration for the visiting astronomers. Only about half the members of Pickering's Committee on Spectral Classification, first convened at Mount Wilson, had come to the Bonn meeting. Those present included Henry Norris Russell, Karl Schwarzschild, Herbert Hall Turner, and of course Kustner of the local observatory. They met Thursday afternoon, July 31st, to polish their report before Friday's discussion and vote. The group had considered incorporating some symbols into the Draper classification that would account for the widths of spectral lines, but ultimately rejected the idea. Rather than retrofit the Draper system, they preferred to look forward and explore the possibility of an entirely new design for stellar taxonomy. On Friday morning, Chairman Pickering read the committee's recommendation to the full assembly at the Physical Institute. He proposed postponing the permanent and universal adoption of any system until the committee could formulate a suitable revision. In the interim, however, everyone should foster the well-known and widely praised Draper classification. Approval of the resolution was swift and unanimous. Ditto the sub-resolution regarding a refinement originally suggested by Einar Hertzsprung and already practiced by Miss Cannon. It consisted of a zero subscript for lone letters. Going forward, A sub-zero would denote a star of purely A-category attributes, showing no B tendencies whatever. The new A sub-zero reduced plain A to a rough categorization. At the final session on August 5th, the Solar Union dissolved its old committees and regrouped into new ones for the work to be done over the next 3 years, before they would all meet again in Rome. When the names of committees were read, wrote Miss Cannon, I was very much surprised to find that I was put on the Committee of Classification of Stellar Spectra, and one of the novel experiences of the summer was to meet with this committee. They sat at a long table, these men of many nations, and I was the only woman. Since I have done almost all the world's work in this one branch, it was necessary for me to do most of the talking. Chapter 10. The Pickering Fellows. Year-end holiday greeting cards from the Harvard College Observatory in 1913 featured a single gold star, with a word at each point naming the five stellar data: position, motion, brightness, spectrum, and color. On Miss Cannon's card, Professor Pickering penned in his personal best wishes for a merry classification and a happy new type of spectrum. Miss Cannon was classifying or reclassifying approximately 5,000 stars per month. Along the way, she reinstated two of Mrs. Fleming's categories, N and R, putting R ahead of N. The alphabetical disorder of her system was ultimately conquered by a new mnemonic. Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me right now. Astronomers from all over Europe and the United States, while awaiting publication of the revised Draper catalog, often queried Miss Cannon about the spectrum of particular stars for their studies. One of her many regular correspondents, Herbert Hall Turner of Oxford, tendered his congratulations on March 13, 1914, regarding an honor unanimously and cordially conferred on her that very day. She received no official notice, however, until early May, when an embarrassed Arthur Stanley Eddington, secretary of the Royal Astronomical Society, apologized to Miss Cannon for the oversight. A form of diploma is being prepared, which you will receive before long, Eddington promised. But of course it was intended that you should be informed at once. The mistake seems to have been due to a misunderstanding between the president, Edmund Herbert Grove Hills, and myself as to which one of us had undertaken the letter. Our best excuse is that the election of an honorary member is so rare an occurrence that we have no routine way of procedure, so that mistakes are not provided against. 8 years had passed since Mrs. Fleming's election, and by 1914 all the previous honorees, save for Lady Margaret Huggins, had passed on. Miss Leavitt's work likewise drew wide attention, though not the formal accolades of the kind Miss Cannon reaped. Nor did Miss Leavitt travel to international gatherings, but remained at the observatory, sometimes in a supervisory capacity when other officers were away. Bailey, who often played that role, commended her fitness for it, with her nature full of sunshine and her ready perception of everything worthy and lovable in others. The stars that had led Miss Leavitt to her period luminosity relation were called Cepheids, for the group archetype Delta Cephei in the constellation Cepheus, the king. In mythology, Cepheus was the father of Andromeda, the chained woman. In the sky, these two lie on either side of Queen Cassiopeia, Andromeda's mother. John Goodrick of England was the first, in 1785, to describe Delta Cephei's pattern of variation, the sharp rise and slow ebb of brightness that proved characteristic of variable stars in other constellations as well. Some 30 Cepheids were known in the 1890s, before Solon Bailey began discovering scores more in the star clusters of the southern hemisphere. Later, Miss Leavitt made their number legion. By mid-January 1914, when she had finished counting the variables in her third of the sky and concluded her many years of work on the North Polar sequence, the Cepheids were beckoning new followers. Harlow Shapley, a young American astronomer completing graduate studies under Henry Norris Russell at Princeton, visited Harvard in March 1914. Pickering welcomed him in typical fashion, offering to provide any materials from the observatory that he wanted. Miss Cannon took him home to dinner, and when he went to call on Solon Bailey, upstairs by the observatory dome, he received advice that shaped the course of his career. Bailey was pious and kind, a wonderful sort of man, Shapley later rhapsodized, but so New England it made you ache. Shapley came from rural Missouri and had worked as a crime reporter for a Kansas daily before pursuing his higher education. According to Shapley's account of their conversation, possibly recorded in newspaperman's shorthand, Bailey said, "I hoped you wanted to come up here. I have been wanting to ask you to do something. We hear that you are going to Mount Wilson. When you get there, why don't you use the big telescope to make measures of stars in globular clusters?" Few besides Bailey found these stellar swarms appealing, and Bailey himself lacked access to a telescope large enough to probe them deeply, either from Cambridge or from Arequipa. As often as Shapley could gain his own observing time on Mount Wilson's 60-inch reflecting telescope, he did as Bailey requested. "Within a month or two after I got to Mount Wilson," Shapley recorded in a memoir, "Shapley and the globular clusters became synonyms." In the clusters, he found new examples of Miss Leavitt's stars. Soon, he developed a theory about their nature. The Cepheids were not closely orbiting pairs, as most astronomers believed, but enormous, isolated individuals. He could claim as much because their sudden surges in brightness seemed to indicate outbursts of some kind, not a pattern of eclipses by a partner star. The Cepheids owed their variation, Shapley hypothesized, to dramatic pulsations in temperature and diameter. He described them as throbbing or vibrating masses of gas. A number of new Cepheids found by Shapley displayed the long periods indicative of great brightness, according to Miss Leavitt's law. These gave Shapley a way to ascertain their positions and the distribution of the clusters in space. He adapted the techniques Einar Hertzsprung had used for deducing distances from period and magnitude, and began measuring the way out to some of the 100 clusters he could see. He noticed a group of them, a cluster of clusters, huddled together in a section of the Milky Way near the constellation Sagittarius, the Archer. He wondered what was so special about that particular area. The outbreak of the Great War in Europe hobbled astronomy there and placed a new imperative on the United States, as Pickering saw things, to sustain all fields of scientific research. He found himself in what seemed an ideal position to aid fellow scientists, as the recently appointed executive chair of the new Committee of 100 on Research, established in 1914 by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His efforts got off to a bad start, however, when his early official appeals on behalf of 4 physics and astronomy projects failed to win funding from the Carnegie Institution. As for the needs of his own institution, Pickering never tired of reminding President Lowell that Harvard contributed nothing to the observatory's support. Fear of fire still fueled the director's oft-repeated plea for more brick structures to replace the wooden ones. And he sighed with relief every time a manuscript series of observations found permanence in a published volume of the Annals. For several years up to and including 1914, expenses had exceeded income, forcing Pickering to curtail activities. In December 1914, however, the observatory received a large new sum under regrettable circumstances. During the last year, Pickering wrote in his annual report, the observatory has lost, by the death of Anna Palmer Draper, its most generous benefactor. She had died at home in New York of pneumonia on December 8th. It rarely happens that a woman maintains for many years a great scientific enterprise and by monthly subscriptions shows her unfailing interest in it. Mrs. Draper, for nearly 30 years, supported the Henry Draper Memorial and by her will placed it upon a permanent foundation. The terms of Mrs. Draper's will promised the observatory the sum of $150,000, in addition to the $250,000 she had already given, for the purpose of caring for, preserving, studying, and using the photographic plates of the Henry Draper Memorial. Anticipating a lengthy probate, Mrs. Draper had instructed her executors to pay the observatory $4,000 the year of her death and $5,000 every year thereafter until her estate was settled, so the work of the memorial could continue uninterrupted. An article in the New York Times on December 20th about her several bequests mistakenly identified her husband as a former professor of astronomy at Harvard. She had willed her country house in Dobbs Ferry to a nephew on the Palmer side, and although she left legacies to niece and nephew, Carlotta and Draper Maury, she made no allowance for their older sister, Antonia. Miss Cannon wrote a lengthy obituary notice for Science, in which she compared Mrs. Draper to another woman of her acquaintance, Lady Margaret Huggins. It is interesting to note that the wives of two of the men connected with the beginnings of this science played such important parts in the careers of their husbands. For Mrs. Draper, not only was her husband's associate in his investigations during the 15 years of their lives together, but after his early death in 1882, she was able to provide for carrying on his work in a most efficient manner. Miss Cannon did not mention her own part in the continuation of that work, except to say, in 1911, observations were commenced for the new Draper catalog, which will contain the spectra of at least 200,000 stars situated over the entire sky. In this work, Mrs. Draper was greatly interested until the very last, and wrote encouragingly about its progress. When Lady Margaret Huggins died a few months later, in March 1915, Miss Cannon wrote her obituary too. Eddington of the Royal Astronomical Society accepted the notice for publication in the observatory. It gives me quite a new appreciation of her personality, he said in his thanks to Miss Cannon on July 3rd. In the same letter, Eddington, a Quaker and therefore a pacifist, lamented the violent turn of current events. It is very sad, after the jolly days in Bonn, that this division should have come between us and our German colleagues. The Zeppelin that had so delighted the visiting astronomers in 1913 had become a force of destruction, dropping bombs on Great Britain. If only there was mutual respect between the combatants, it would be a less depressing outlook, Eddington wrote. But I am afraid the contempt and hatred of Germans has increased over here very much in the last 3 months, though I personally have not yet got to the length of imagining, say, Max Wolf as a pirate and baby killer. The knowledge that we have the sympathy of nearly all American astronomers is much appreciated, because you have so much more opportunity than we have of learning what is to be said in favor of the other side. Pickering, too, rued the war's undoing of the friendly ties binding observatories around the world. Already, the usual course of international communication regarding comets and asteroids had been disrupted. Copenhagen took the place of Kiel, Germany, as the designated European clearinghouse for such information. But most astronomers on the continent were cut off. Even the cables to Copenhagen became problematic when military sensors on both sides of the Atlantic refused to permit the use of ciphers, over the protests of astronomers who had always coded their messages by substituting words for digits to avoid errors in transmitting long strings of numbers. Pleased with Margaret Harwood's three productive summers on Nantucket, the Mariah Mitchell Association granted her a quadrennial year, beginning June 15, 1915, to spend as she liked while still collecting her stipend of $1,000. She chose to go west, to assist at the Lick Observatory on Mount Hamilton, while taking her master's degree in astronomy at the University of California, Berkeley. "Dear Miss Cannon," she wrote June 23rd on Lick Stationery, "this letter is really to both you and Professor Pickering." She had too much to say to try to say it all twice. The trip out was perfect in every way. Miss Harwood had stayed with Edwin and Mary Frost at the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, and been entertained by Percival Lowell's staff and Flagstaff. In the Pasadena office and workshop of the Mount Wilson Observatory, she had met Harlow Shapley. "I was having a good time talking variables with Mr. Shapley that first afternoon," Miss Harwood reported, "when his telephone rang, and he answered by asking whoever wanted him to call up again in half an hour. I objected, but he said it was nothing important, and we went on. In about three quarters of an hour more, the telephone rang again, and I started to go. He called me back saying that Mrs. Shapley was just calling to find out if I was coming to dinner with him. She had called before, but he was too busy talking to ask such an everyday question. So I went and had a delightful time. Mrs. Shapley is very attractive and young, and if possible, more of a shark than her husband." Shapley had married his college sweetheart, Martha Betts, in Kansas City in April 1914. Then boarded the train with her for a honeymoon trip to their new home in Pasadena. She was working for her philology degree at Bryn Mawr when she married, Miss Harwood continued. "She plays the piano finely, tends the three-month-old baby girl, who is also a wonder and most attractive, and is a wonderful cook. Mr. Shapley has taught her astronomy so that she measures plates, works out the light curve of variables, and writes out the discussion by herself. She is very shy and retiring, and I found out almost nothing about her until I questioned Mr. Shapley on the way home, to the boarding house where several Mount Wilson computers lived. She did play to me, however." The following day saw Miss Harwood ascend the winding road to the Mount Wilson summit, where she overnighted. "I stayed up until 1 a.m. watching Mr. Shapley photograph certain clusters, and I took a plate on Messier 3 with the 60-inch. I have not seen the plate yet, and so better not be bragging. At 12 o'clock, Mr. Hoag, the night assistant, makes cocoa in the kitchen of the 60-inch dome, and we had a regular feast of strawberries, cocoa, toast, and pilot bread. As each observer works all night, the midnight meal is very necessary and must go to the right spot." Miss Harwood's big news for her mentors at Harvard concerned a forwarded letter that she had found waiting for her in Berkeley. It came from Ellen Fitz Pendleton, the president of Wellesley College, offering her a position as an instructor at a salary of not less than $1,200 beginning in the 1916-1917 academic year, with the strong possibility of promotion and a pay increase in 1917 and 18. The timing would allow her to complete her master's degree, but she needed to make the Wellesley decision now. Miss Cannon might well have thrilled at the prospect of her protege on the faculty of her alma mater, but she balked at the thought that teaching would take Miss Harwood away from her ongoing research regarding the light curve of the asteroid Eros. Lydia Hinchman at the Mariah Mitchell Association, who had been a teacher herself, thought abandoning research a terrible idea. "I do not want to see her exchange the life of an astronomer for that of a teacher," Mrs. Hinchman insisted to Miss Cannon on September 7, 1915. "A teacher grows weary and old before her time. But if I may judge from you, my dear Miss Cannon, an astronomer is always young." Acting quickly, Mrs. Hinchman proposed that the association's board designate Miss Harwood as the permanent fellow, as well as the director of the Mariah Mitchell Observatory, with a salary to match the Wellesley offer. Her plan drew strong resistance from board member Anne Sewell Young of Mount Holyoke College. "While I value highly the very excellent work which Miss Harwood has done at Harvard, as well as at Nantucket," Dr. Young argued, "and appreciate the tact and good judgment which have so endeared her to the residents of Nantucket, I cannot approve of appointing a permanent fellow as director of the Nantucket Observatory. I strongly believe that the cause of astronomy, as well as that of women's education, will gain far more by continuing to offer one or more fellowships, giving opportunities for study and research to various women of ability or promise. Those of us who are teaching know how few, even now, are the opportunities offered to women, and have been proud of this fellowship in astronomy." Miss Mitchell's interest in her girls was so great that it seems to me she would herself choose this for her memorial. "I am very certain that my opinion is that of Professor Caroline Furness of Vassar, who did so much toward raising the fund. Also of Professor Harriet Bigelow of Smith and Professor Sarah Whiting of Wellesley College." Mrs. Hinchman bristled. As a blood relative of Miss Mitchell, she did not appreciate outsiders' interpretations of the deceased astronomer's wishes. Moreover, Mrs. Hinchman and her husband, Charles, had contributed by far the largest sum and greatest effort toward the establishment of the fellowship. She steeled herself to sway the board toward her opinion. "Meeting is set for October 6th at the College Club," she informed Miss Cannon, head of the fellowship committee. "I think they should know about Miss Harwood's work and experiences in the West. I shall, too, make it as plain as I courteously can that our observatory was meant for research. It was in no sense intended as a training school for teachers, and the height of our efficiency seems to me to have been reached when its advantages provide the opportunity for a fellow to complete undertaken work." The other members voted along with her, and thereby made Miss Harwood, who happily accepted the directorship, the only woman in the world in charge of an independent observatory. She was 30 years old, the same age as Pickering when he took over at Harvard. No sooner had Mrs. Hinchman won her way on Miss Harwood's account than she saw the virtue of creating a second astronomical fellowship at Nantucket. She put together a committee that spent a year soliciting funds from Nantucketers, Harvard friends, and former students of Mariah Mitchell. On November 16, 1916, in the Harvard Observatory, distinguished Vassar alumna Florence Cushing handed Pickering a check for $12,000 as an added surprise at the big surprise party celebrating his 40th year as director. "It is our wish," Miss Cushing told him, "that you will accept it with full power as to its use, and that in the future it will be managed with the same broad-minded fairness to women which has characterized your administration." The committee had thought of calling the second stipend the Harvard Fellowship, but President Lowell pointed out that the university's name could not be attached to a fund controlled by an individual. At that, the Mariah Mitchell Association moved to rename its new annual award the Edward C. Pickering Astronomical Fellowship for Women. "President Wilson has severed diplomatic relations with Germany," Miss Cannon wrote in her diary on Sunday, February 4, 1917. "The terrible submarine warfare is on again." Pickering had discussed the submarine threat with the chairman of the U.S. Navy's consulting board, Thomas Edison, at the start of the hostilities, suggesting strategies, and offering all the resources of the Committee of 100 on Research. After the United States declared war on Germany in April 1917, Pickering bent his inventive mind more urgently to military needs. Together with Willard Gerrish, the observatory's resident mechanical genius, he devised a means for heavy artillery operators to orient their equipment. The new device, like Pickering's early photometers, relied on sighting the North Star. The War Department welcomed his model of the Harvard Polaris attachment and informed him of its plans to produce the instrument. At Mount Wilson, Harlow Shapley announced his plans to enlist in the Coast Artillery. But Director George Ellery Hale advised him not to, on the grounds that he would likely be needed to help with crucial optical projects for the National Research Council. Shapley agreed to stay in Pasadena for the time being, keeping up his observations of clusters and Cepheids. "Very much of my work on clusters," Shapley wrote to Bailey on January 30, 1917, "has been the direct result of my conversation with you in Cambridge 3 years ago, when you suggested the advantages of the Mount Wilson instruments and weather, and when you expressed the hope that I would join in the study." Since then, Shapley had determined the distances to all the clusters that contained Cepheid-type variable stars, thanks to the period-luminosity relation. In so doing, he had assumed that Miss Leavitt's law was not limited to the Magellanic clouds, but could govern conditions anywhere. To place the clusters not containing Cepheids, Shapley combined a variety of means and assumptions to leapfrog his way across space. Often, he relied on other cluster variables that were faster paced than Cepheids, but which seemed also to obey Miss Leavitt's law. In August, he wanted to pursue this line of thought with her, but she was away on vacation in Nantucket, visiting Miss Harwood. In clusters too distant to reveal any variables, Shapley averaged the magnitudes of the 30 brightest stars he could espy. He then compared these averages with the average luminosity of the Cepheid-containing clusters and deduced the greater distances accordingly. For clusters too far removed to be resolved into any stars at all, Shapley measured the one thing he could see, their apparent overall diameters, which he compared with the diameters of clusters whose distances he had already determined. Shapley gauged the average cluster diameter to be about 150 light years, or 900 trillion miles across. The range of cluster distances from the sun reached the still more staggering numbers of 15,000 to 200,000 light years. No other astronomer had stretched the bounds of the known universe to those extreme dimensions. A chance encounter with ants on Mount Wilson briefly turned Shapley's attention from the very big and distant to the small and close at hand. While watching patrols of trail runner ants traverse the back of a concrete building, he noticed that they slowed from a run to a walk as they passed through the shade of the manzanita bushes. At first, he presumed the ants were enjoying a cool respite, just as he was doing at that moment. "I began to wonder about this, however," he recalled in his autobiography. "And soon I got a thermometer and a barometer and a hydrometer and all those ometers and a stopwatch. I set up a sort of observing station while resting and getting ready for another night's tussle with the globular clusters." Shapley found that the ants set their pace by the ambient temperature. The higher the mercury, the faster they ran, even when carrying loads. No other factors, such as air pressure or humidity, affected their rate of travel. "I found it great fun to watch them." Recording his ant observations as carefully as he treated any other scientific phenomenon, Shapley arrived at a temperature-speed ratio. He clocked ants in 35-degree cold, limae topum apiculatum on the edge of a snowbank, and 103-degree heat, Tapinoma sessile, in the den of Shapley's Pasadena home. where he stripped off his clothes and turned up the thermostat to test the limit of the ant's tolerance. He claimed he could tell the air temperature to within 1 degree by watching half a dozen ants pass through his speed trap. And he published his data on ant thermokinetics in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In time, Shapley came to see the globular clusters as the scaffolding of the cosmos. Just as the planets orbited the sun in a broad, flat plane, all the clusters appeared to occupy the same plane as the Milky Way. Together, the clusters described an enormous ring around the perimeter of the galaxy. Shapley could tell by the distribution of the clusters that his own vantage point, atop Mount Wilson, riding planet Earth around the sun, stood nowhere near the center of this great circle. Were he situated at the galactic center, he reasoned, he would see the clusters evenly spaced around him. As it was, when he looked in one direction, he saw a sparse string of clusters, and in the opposite direction, the cluster of clusters in Sagittarius. He concluded the center must lie in that direction. The sun, though the center of the solar system, was not the hub of the universe. Some of my series of papers on globular clusters published in 1917 and 1918 were rather revolutionary, because the findings opened up a part of the universe that had not been known before. He wrote of his bold speculation. In Shapley's new cosmic picture, the solar system is off-center, and consequently, man is too, which is a rather nice idea because it means that man is not such a big chicken. He is incidental. My favorite term is peripheral. There was no telling how far into space astronomers might penetrate by the light of Miss Leavitt's stars. Having limned the extent of the Milky Way on a foundation of Cepheids, Shapley recognized the need to refine Miss Leavitt's magnitude measurements to make sure they were strong enough to support his conclusions. In a letter to Pickering on July 20, 1918, Shapley stated, "I believe the most important photometric work that can be done on Cepheid variables at the present time is a study of the Harvard plates of the Magellanic Clouds. Probably Miss Leavitt's many other problems have interrupted and delayed her work on the variables of the clouds for the interval of 6 or 7 years since her preliminary work was published. No doubt her illness, which had been diagnosed as cancer, figured chief among Miss Leavitt's problems, though her many other scientific assignments had effectively barred her from further pursuit of her Cepheid discoveries." Shapley closed his letter with a prediction. "The theory of stellar variation, the laws of stellar luminosities, the arrangement of objects throughout the whole galactic system, the structure of the clouds, all these problems will benefit directly or indirectly from a further knowledge of the Cepheid variables." The members of the AAVSO, those devoted observers of the long period variables, met in November 1918 at the Harvard College Observatory. They had been accustomed to getting together in Connecticut or New Jersey at the homes of the association's officers. But now that Leon Campbell had returned from Peru and resumed close communication with the volunteers, the observatory served as the new unofficial headquarters. To further cement the Harvard connection, the organization inducted Solon Bailey, Annie Cannon, Henrietta Leavitt, and Edward Pickering as honorary members, with a special tribute for the director. "He has assisted us in everything that we have undertaken and has carefully watched our progress along every step of the way." Founder William Tyler Olcott compared Pickering's manner to that of a benevolent older brother. In 1918, part one of the long-awaited revision of the Henry Draper catalog by Annie J. Cannon and Edward C. Pickering appeared in print. Pickering personally covered the cost to publish it as volume 91 of the Annals and described the process of its preparation in his preface. "Beyond Miss Cannon's 4 years of unfailing enthusiasm and persistent work, in reclassifying the spectra of 222,000 stars. She had also invested 2 years in writing remarks and otherwise readying the material for printing. At least 5 assistants at a time, though not always the same 5, had aided her throughout. Pickering named Mrs. Grace R. Brooks, Alta M. Carpenter, Florence Cushman, Edith F. Gill, Mabel A. Gill, Marion A. Hawes, Hannah S. Locke, Joan C. Mackey, Louisa D. Wells, and Marion A. White, as the ones who had ascertained the positions and magnitudes of every star included, as well as helped proofread the hundreds of pages of tables and text. He stressed the efficiency of the women's effort and cooperation. A loss of 1 minute in the production of each estimate would delay the publication of the entire work by the equivalent of the time of one assistant for 2 years. By this point, Pickering, who liked to keep count of everything, figured the observatory had satisfied 37,000 outside requests for spectral classifications. Projecting the frequency with which astronomers would consult the printed authority far into the future, he took pains to choose paper that should not be affected by time. Although experts had assured him a rag content of 60% would be more than adequate, he opted for 80 instead, despite the added expense. It is hoped that these volumes, 8 more were to follow the current issue, will form a lasting tribute to the memory of both Dr. and Mrs. Draper. A tipped-in frontispiece illustrated the principal types of spectra, B through M, with their distinguishing features. But both Pickering's preface and Miss Cannon's coda apologized that these reproductions portrayed only a fraction of the Fraunhofer lines visible in the original glass negatives. For the second volume of the catalog, Annals Volume 92, which came out later the same year, the authors chose a studio portrait of Henry Draper as the frontispiece. It depicted the doctor in 2/3 facial view, with an expression serious but not stern, and a few stray locks of hair jutting out by his ear. The same photograph had served as the model for the Henry Draper Gold Medal awarded by the National Academy of Sciences. On Christmas Day, 1918, Pickering wrote a brief preface for installment number 3 of the catalog series. The Henry Draper Memorial is due to the unfailing devotion of Mrs. Draper to the memory of her husband, he reflected. It seems, therefore, very appropriate that her portrait should appear as a frontispiece to this, the third volume of the greatest work yet undertaken as part of the Henry Draper Memorial. Mrs. Draper, seen here in profile, looked ready to welcome guests at one of her Academy dinners. She wore a gown with exquisite lacework, and her red hair pinned up in tight ringlets. Well before the World War ended, Pickering began agitating for the resumption of international relations among scientists. In August 1918, he had told George Ellery Hale, "No ordinary punishment is adequate for those responsible for barbarities contrary to the laws of nations and humanity. Yet we ought not to ignore the work of those who, laboring quietly in their observatories, have done their best to extend our knowledge in these terrible times." After the armistice of November 1918, Pickering declared himself eager to write to longtime friends in Germany as soon as mail communication could be restored. "I am anxious to know how far European observatories have suffered," he said in a letter to Elise Stromgren of the Osterwald Observatory in Copenhagen on January 7, 1919, "and what is likely to be their condition when the peace treaties are actually signed." He resented the sentiments of certain colleagues in the United States and the United Kingdom, who talked of excluding scientists of enemy or neutral nations from post-war professional societies. "I believe that many astronomers agree with me," he told Stromgren, "that we should make every effort for the advancement of our science, regardless of personal or national considerations." Later that month, however, Pickering's own efforts came to an end. His strength suddenly failed him while he was working at the observatory, and he needed to be helped over the few steps home to his residence. The cause of his death, on February 3rd, was given as pneumonia. Edward Pickering had been director of the Harvard College Observatory for 42 years, serving longer than the combined tenures of all his predecessors. Anguish at his loss was widespread. I warmly admired his great ability, his originality of view, his power of organization, and his unwearied initiative. George Ellery Hale wrote to Solon Bailey on February 4th. I also appreciated how much he did, in so many ways, to stimulate research and to help astronomers everywhere. The great development of the observatory under his direction and its immense contribution to the progress of astronomy mark an epoch universally recognized in the advancement of science. Hale, who had volunteered as a Harvard assistant while a student at MIT, said he still remembered Pickering's showing him the original photographs of stellar spectra made by Henry Draper. What I shall remember with greatest pleasure, however, is his kindly interest in me as an unknown amateur when I first came to the observatory. Many others have enjoyed this experience, for the circle of amateurs he touched and helped was a wide one. Bailey, like Hale, had first arrived at the observatory as an amateur volunteer. One of his first duties now as acting director in the great man's absence was to compose Pickering's obituary for Hale's astrophysical journal. For men and women, he had an equal charm, Bailey commented after elaborating on the milestones of the illustrious life story. His grace of manner and conversation was the constant wonder of all who knew him intimately. Overall, old and young, wise and witty or ignorant and stupid, who seemed to have any claim upon him, he threw the glamour of his personality. Bailey spoke also of the library of glass plates, gathered pole to pole and year to year as the repository of Pickering's guiding spirit. It still exists. Its possibilities by no means exhausted, its value in many ways increasing as the years go by. Within this great collection of stellar photographs, there still remains for Professor Pickering the possibility of an immortality of scientific labor, more unique and worthy than ordinary fame. Miss Cannon, the consummate master of obituary form, sketched the director's much-admired qualities in popular astronomy. He will be missed for his warm-heartedness, always eager to help the young astronomer, whether by securing grants of funds or in the selection of his life work, for his cordiality, the ideal host in welcoming visitors to the observatory, for his sympathetic, inspiring personality, which, by its very optimism and faith in humanity, made us believe in ourselves and our capabilities. Miss Cannon concluded, his joy in taking part in what he called the greatest problem ever presented to the mind of man, the study of the starry universe, never left him, and even in his last illness, he spoke of having new ideas about work. He measured the light of the stars and first placed them in an orderly evolutionary sequence. He left, as his legacy to the world,